23rd chapter of Luke, beginning at verse 1. Last time we were looking at this book, we finished the 22nd chapter, Messiah's trial by the Sanhedrin. And now in chapter 23, verses 1 through 7, we have our Lord Yeshua before Pilate, the Roman governor. I'm reading with you Luke chapter 23, verses 1 through 7. Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Then Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered and said, "It is as you say." So Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." But they were the more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. The whole multitude here would be, of course, the Sanhedrin. And the reason why they led him to Pilate is because at that time, the Jewish authorities did not have the authority to execute capital punishment. And they took him to the one who had that power, who had authority to kill or to keep alive. In John chapter 19, Pilate reminded the Lord of this. It didn't make any difference to the Lord, but he did say to him there, in John chapter 19 and verse 10, "Then Pilate said to him, 'Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you?' Yeshua answered, 'You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin.'" They led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him. In our translation, we read, "We found this fellow perverting the nation." The word "fellow" isn't there. It was a tone of contempt. "We found this one." They didn't even bother to give him due courtesy. It was a tone of contempt, and it was nothing new. Whenever he trod on their toes, they said, "Who is this?" For example, "Who is this that forgives sins?" "We found this perverting," three things they mention here: perverting the nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Messiah, a king. First of all, perverting the nation. This is a charge that is brought against God's people in all centuries of history, of the history of God's people, that one of the ways in which they were, one of the things which they were accused of was to pervert the nation or pervert the people or to teach something that was a perversion of the truth. Perverting the nation. Elijah suffered the same penalty when he was about to meet Ahab after 3.5 years of drought. When Ahab saw Elijah, he said, "Are you the one that is troubling Israel?" Well, it was because of Ahab's sin that God had sent a drought upon the nation of Israel. But we read in 1 Kings chapter 18 how Ahab, the king of Israel, foists his guilt on Elijah, the servant of God. It is really when we see the servants of God suffering for righteousness' sake, we are seeing Messiah suffering in and through his people. The Bible makes it clear that when you and I are suffering for God's sake or for the sake of the truth, it is Messiah who suffers with us. In all their affliction, he was afflicted. And so it is here. It was a false accusation. What else did they say? Forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar. Now that was manifestly false. False blame. In chapter 20 and verse 25, they tried to trip him up on this matter of paying tribute to Caesar. Chapter 20, verse 22. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Verse 25. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. The Lord obviously said, pay dues to whom it is incumbent upon you to do so. And there was another incident where Peter was accosted by those who collected tribute. It's found in Matthew chapter 17, verse 24 through 27. Matthew 17, verse 24 through 27. Now, when they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the temple tax? He said, yes. And when he had come into the house, Yeshua anticipated him, saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers? Peter said to him, from strangers. Yeshua said to him, then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and you. It's obvious from this passage in Matthew chapter 17 that he was exempt, but he said, for the sake of peace, rather than cause unnecessary conflict and quarreling and blame throwing, give them what they ask. It's what he impressed upon us in the Sermon on the Mount. Whoever compels you to go a mile, go with him too. So the accusation here, when they said forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, was wrong. But the next accusation, the third one, also in verse 2, saying that he himself is Messiah, a king, that is something he did affirm. He claimed that. In chapter 22, verse 70. Chapter 22 of Luke, verse 70. Then they all said, are you then the Son of God? So he said to them, you rightly say that I am. He had just been saying in verse 69, hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. He was referring to that prophecy in Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel had a vision of the Son of Man coming with the clouds of glory before the Ancient of Days, and to him was given dominion and power and glory that all nations and peoples and tongues should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, said Daniel, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. So when they say here, he himself is Christ the King, they were right. At least in one of their accusations, they were saying the truth. But here is an example of how people can misuse the truth to convey a false impression. And that was the case here. They used that because Caesar was the one that to whom they should have owed allegiance. And they were inferring here, they were hinting that Yeshua was the rival to Caesar. Pilate wanted to affirm this for himself. In verse 3, then Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" The emphasis there is on the pronoun. Are you? He could hardly believe that the one standing before him with bruised face, spit running down his face from the time they beat him up and spat in his face. They brought him like that in that disgraceful condition before Pilate. Black eye perhaps, swollen face from the blows he had received. You, the king of the Jews? It was disbelief. It was surprise. It was the fulfillment of what God said to the prophet Isaiah in chapter 53 and verse 2. He has no form or comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Usually, to a Roman governor, a king was someone who appeared in royal state. This one appeared before him beaten and battered and bruised. But the Lord calmly replied, "It is as you say. It is as you say." In other words, you've said it. But Pilate recognized from the bearing of the man that was before him that this was no threat to Caesar, that this man was speaking of another kingdom altogether. So in verse 4, Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no fault in this man. His spiritual claim is no threat to me." The Lord Jesus had said to Pilate, for this, well, let's look at it. John chapter 18, verse 37. John 18, verse 37. "For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." He was here not to raise a rebellion against Caesar, but rather to call people to the truth. God's servant Jeremiah also suffered like this from a mob that sought to destroy him. In Jeremiah chapter 26, there's an example of another of God's suffering servants. Verse 12, they had been on the point of lynching him because of what he spoke about the destruction of Jerusalem that was coming. He had foretold Jerusalem and the temple would be destroyed. This was too much for the people and for the priests and for the false prophets. Verse 11, Jeremiah 26, verse 11. "And the priests and the prophets spoke to the princes and all the people, saying, 'This man deserves to die, for he has prophesied against this city, as you have heard with your ears.'" Jeremiah didn't back down an inch from what he had said. Verse 12, "Then Jeremiah spoke to all the princes and all the people, saying, 'The Lord sent me to prophesy against this house and against this city with all the words that you have heard. Now therefore amend your ways and your doings and obey the voice of the Lord your God.'" He was not going to apologize for what God had told him to tell them. And he went on to say in verse 15, "But know for certain that if you put me to death, you will surely bring innocent blood on yourselves, on this city, and on this inhabitants. For truly the Lord has sent me to you to speak all these words in your hearing." What was the result of the princes? The people, the priests, the false prophets were all ganged up against Jeremiah. But by the time Jeremiah had finished speaking, the princes who had come to adjudicate on the matter found that the people swung around on their side as well. And verse 16 says, "So the princes and all the people said to the priests and the prophets, 'This man does not deserve to die, for he has spoken unto us in the name of the Lord our God.'" So Jeremiah was rescued just in the nick of time by the princes, but also by the people who now heard both sides of the story. That's the problem with so many disputes today. Someone hears something and they get all riled up and they're about to breathe fire and brimstone. The Bible says, "He that answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and it is shame to him." How we jump to conclusions. The people realized their error and they were prudent enough to back away from condemning Jeremiah to death. So we come back to Luke chapter 23. When Pilate said, "I find no fault in this man," they were the more fierce. If you cannot prove your point, bluster. That is the world's philosophy. If you cannot bring convincing proof, just rage and storm and bluster and shout and drown out the voice of the opposition. That's what they did. Verse 5. "But they were the more fierce, saying, 'He stirs up the people.'" Who was he stirring up? We read throughout the book of Luke that great multitudes followed him. The only ones he did stir up were the ones that were in opposition to him, like these ones that were his accusers. "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." They accused him of something that was true. He had been teaching throughout Galilee and throughout Judea. When Galilee was mentioned, Pilate asked if he was a Galilean, and from the reply that he got in verse 7, as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, it looks as though the people weren't quite sure whether he had been born in Galilee or not. As it turns out, he was not born in Galilee, although he spent his boyhood and his manhood there. He was born in Bethlehem of Judah. But by now, that knowledge had become obscured. And all he could get from them by way of reply was, "Well, he belongs to that territory that is under Herod's jurisdiction." And this Herod was the one that had taken his brother Philip's wife, one who had murdered John the Baptist, who was a persecutor later on of the apostles, who died that miserable death recorded for us in the book of Acts chapter 12. His name was Antipas. Messiah called him a fox. "He sent him to Herod," verse 7, "who was also in Jerusalem at that time." At last, maybe he could get this embarrassing situation off his hands. Herod was in Jerusalem at that time because it was customary for Herod to be in Jerusalem at the time of Passover. From verse 8 through 12, we read about Yeshua before Herod. "Now when Herod saw Yeshua, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with each other. Herod saw Jesus, and he was exceedingly glad, because he, for a long time, he had wanted to see him. In chapter 9 of Luke, verse 7 through 9, we have the record of how Herod said, "I want to see this man." Chapter 9, verse 7 through 9. Now Herod the Tetrarch heard of all that was done by him, and he was perplexed, because it was said by some that John had risen from the dead, and by some that Elijah had appeared, and by others that one of the old prophets had risen again. Herod said, "John I have beheaded, but who is this of whom I hear such things?" So he sought to see him, and at last here he was, handed over just so freely and so easily. He was exceeding glad. But he wasn't exceeding glad because he wanted to hear how he could become a follower of God. No, he hoped to see some miracle done by him. He had heard many things about him, and one of the things he may have heard was what Messiah said when the Pharisees came to him. In chapter 13 of Luke, we read how the Pharisees came to him and said, "Get away from this area." This is the area over which Herod has the rule, and he's looking to kill you. Luke 13, verse 31. On that very day, some Pharisees came, saying to him, "Get out and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you." And he said to them, "Go, tell that fox, 'Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. Nevertheless, I must journey today, tomorrow, and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside of Jerusalem.'" That is maybe what Herod heard via the Pharisees, who would have relayed back this message to him. The Lord had said, "I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow." "Oh, let's see one of those," says Herod here. He hoped to see some miracle done by him. A sensationalist. Maybe one of the things that Herod heard about him was through his nobleman. In John chapter 4, we read about a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. And this nobleman was probably a member of Herod's court. That man had gone all the way up to Cana of Galilee to find Yeshua and to plead with him, "Sir, come down, lay your hand upon my son, that he may not die." The Lord at first tested him. He said, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will in no wise believe." The nobleman then pleaded with God, humbled himself before Yeshua, and the Lord Yeshua said, "Go home. Your son lives." The man believed the word. When he was on his way home, he intercepted his servants who told him, "Your son lives." And he asked them of the time, and he realized it was the same time that the Lord Yeshua had spoken to him and said, "Your son lives." He himself believed, and all his family as a result of that miracle of mercy. Maybe this man was able to speak to Herod and tell him, he did a wonderful thing for my son. It's possible that Herod had heard that from one of his noblemen. We know that one of the Lord's faithful women followers was Joanna, the wife of Chuza, the steward of Herod. So Herod had voices for Yeshua right there in his court, and now he had the man himself. Verse 9, questioned with him with many words, but he answered him nothing. The Lord was not going to say a word to him. Herod had had a lot to ask from John the Baptist. He heard him gladly. He did many things, but in the end he murdered him. And the Lord's reply, the Lord's silence was an apt reply to this man. You do not listen to my servant? I have nothing to add. Remember what the Lord Yeshua said to his servants, to his apostles? He that hears you, hears me. He that despises you, despises me. And he that despises me, despises him that sent me. The Lord had nothing to say to this man who'd had every opportunity to mend his ways and to turn to God. The silence of God is a terrible thing. It's bad enough when God speaks to you and to me in displeasure, but we can, at the same time as we are trembling in ourselves because of his voice of displeasure, we can thank him that he is interested enough in us to go on talking to us. Whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Thank God that you're interested enough in me to put me right. But the silence of God is a sentence of doom. And so it was to Herod. Not long after this, he was eaten with worms and gave up his spirit. He answered him nothing. Now, at the same time, his accusers had much to say. Verse 10. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. The word means they accused him to the full extent of their power. And when Herod found he could get not a word out of the Lord, he resorted to this cheap method of mockery. Verse 11. Treated him with contempt and mocked him. Arrayed him with a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. In Psalm 62, David is the writer, and he describes his sufferings, also at his unjust sufferings, in language that is reminiscent. Psalm 62, verse 4. They only consult to cast him down from his high position. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly. They mocked him, but they probably mocked him by giving him false honor. And then sent him back to Pilate. Uncondemned, verse 12 tells us that very day Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with each other. The reason for that enmity we do not know, but it's possible that it is because of what we read in chapter 13. That there were some Galileans who came up to the temple to do sacrifice, and while they were offering their sacrifices, Pilate fell upon them with his soldiers and slaughtered them, massacred them, so that their blood was mingled with the blood of their sacrifices. It could be that that is what caused Herod to be hostile towards Pilate. These men were Galileans. These men were under my jurisdiction. How dare you lay a hand upon them? How dare you oppose my authority over these men? Maybe that was the reason. At any rate, they had been at enmity, they'd been hostile, rival powers, rival claims to authority. But now they had a common scapegoat and they were able to patch up their differences. What we do see here is the false king of Israel, false king of Judah, Herod. He was not descended from the tribe of Judah. He was an Idumean, that is, an Edomite. His father had usurped the title King of the Jews. And now we find this one rejecting the one to whom the scepter really belonged. And hence, the scepter departed from Israel. In the book of Hosea, God says, the people of Israel shall abide many days without a king and without a prince. Afterward, shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. It was a symbolic setting aside the claims of Yeshua, the rightful claims of Yeshua, to be the king. The Pharisees had rejected him. Herod had rejected him. And therefore, the scepter was laid aside, taken away. And they, since then, our people have not had a king or a prince. And the word king and prince, the words king and prince are contrasted with one another. King refers to the one that God chose. They'll be without that. Without a prince, that means they'll be without the one of their own choosing. They'll be left without either. After the Herods, there were no more rulers in the nation. Verse 13 through 17, Pilate's verdict. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod. For I sent you back to him. And indeed, nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him. For it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast." He brought them all together. He said to them, "I have considered your charges and I find no fault." Three times Pilate, who himself was an unjust man, said, "I find no fault." Their triple charge was disallowed. And then, by way of concession, but a very unjust concession, he says in verse 16, "I will therefore chastise him and release him." Why chastise him? He had just been saying, "I find no fault in him." It was a concession to the violent hostility of his adversaries. To placate them. He was trying to placate them, committing one injustice in order to try and make amends for another injustice. Two wrongs don't make a right. And it was totally unjust of him to say, "I will chastise him." It's what Isaiah the prophet spoke about in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 8. Isaiah 53, verse 8, speaking of the Messiah, "He was taken from prison and from judgment. And who will declare his generation? for he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people he was stricken. Taken from prison, taken from judgment, that is, snatched out of prison and snatched from the court, so that he was not given a fair trial. Then Pilate remembered that there was a custom that at Pesach, at Passover, verse 17, it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast. Here is a prisoner, I can release him to you. Verse 18 to 25, Pilate overruled. And they all cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas," who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. Why would they ever want someone like that instead? And perhaps they played the leaders of this call, the ones who called out like that, perhaps they played upon the feelings of the people. Why do we want this man, Yeshua of Nazareth? Has he set us free from the Romans? Has he established his kingdom? He has not done all that we expected of the Messiah. He cannot be the right one. Barabbas is closer to the mark. He is prepared to risk his life in order to establish our kingdom over the Romans. And so they thought, we'd get a better chance of getting free of these hated Romans if we take Barabbas instead of this man. Maybe that was part of their reasoning. It's hard to say what else they had in mind. Verse 20, Pilate therefore, wishing to release Yeshua again, called out to them, but they shouted, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Then he said to them the third time, "Why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." Three times he protested. No evident cause of death in him. But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and of the chief priests prevailed. He gave sentence. He was, after all, a weak man. There was another man like that called Zedekiah, king of Judah. Jeremiah had been accused by the princes of having spread an unwelcome message. We find it in Jeremiah chapter 38. Jeremiah chapter 38. Verse 1. I'll read from verse 1. Jeremiah 38, verse 1. Now Shephatiah the son of Mattan, Gedaliah the son of Pashhur, Yukal the son of Shelemiah, and Pashhur the son of Malkiah heard the words that Jeremiah had spoken to all the people, saying, "Thus says the Lord, he who remains in this city shall die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. But he who goes over to the Chaldeans shall live. His life shall be as a prize to him, and he shall live. Thus says the Lord, this city shall surely be given into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which shall take it." Therefore the princes said to the king, "Please, let this man be put to death, for thus he weakens the hands of the men of war who remain in this city, and the hands of all the people by speaking such words to them. For this man does not seek the welfare of this people, but their harm." Then Zedekiah the king said, "Look, he is in your hand, for the king can do nothing against you." Here was another weak ruler who couldn't stand up to the opposition. "Okay, I cannot oppose you. Do what you like with him." They took him and cast him into a dungeon that was filled with evil-smelling sludge and he would have died. He would have died if it hadn't been for an Ethiopian servant of the king who pleaded with the king to pull him out of that dungeon. So the sufferings of Messiah are reflected in the sufferings of his people. Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and surrendered Barabbas. And he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Yeshua to their will. The cry of the world is still the same. We don't want Jesus Christ. We want the one that we have chosen to solve our problems for us. And so this world goes from bad to worse, because the ones they choose turn out to be unwise and in many cases violent leaders, cruel, unjust, unrighteous. Look at some of the countries in this world and we see the choice the people made of rulers, and how it is again the old cry, not this man, but Barabbas. In one case in the history of Israel, we read that God gave them their request, but sent leanness to their souls. And so it turned out here as well. Well, we have to leave it at that for this week, but God willing, next week we look at how the Lord was finally nailed to the tree.